Welcome to another episode of the Whiskey Rebellion. Cheers, Frank.
Hello, David.
What are we drinking this week?
We're drinking 10-year-old Talisker.
Yes, and we are back in Doctors, our spiritual home across the street from the office, where we have escaped on a cloudy and rainy and snowy and 12 other kinds of weather conditions day here in Scotland. We have a bit of news and developments in our staff, as we can say.
Well, staff would be an exaggeration, David, but we have a volunteer assistant named Chloe Sahoon, who we're very happy to welcome to our team. Chloe contacted us. She's a student at the University of Edinburgh, and she is our outreach and digital social media. Is that
outreach and social media assistant?
Excellent.
I think that is the title that she has for the moment. We may elevate her to some other more prestigious title as titles develop.
Yeah, basically, we need somebody because we're old men and we need somebody to manage our social media. we need somebody to manage our social media, and Chloe's going to help us with that, and we're very, very happy to have her on board. And we're going to interview her in due course as well.
Yes. We threatened to do that at least, yes. So, lots going on this week. One of the things that came out, this was President's Day on Monday. We, of course, didn't have President's Day off because they don't recognize President's Day in this country. But
why would they?
Yeah, well, you know, why would they do it to sell mattresses in the United States? But one of the things that came out as part of this President's Day or to correspond with President's Day is one of these presidential rankings that come out every few years. This one came out from C-SPAN, so I thought we would start with that as a topic. What do you think about the idea of ranking presidents?
Well, the other thing is there's also been for President's Day, a British ranking has come out as well. So we've got two sets of rankings that we might have a look at, and they differ in interesting ways. But in answer to your question, David, I mean, these things are ridiculous, but they're exactly the kind of thing you can discuss in the pub.
Well, to be sure.
It's totally appropriate. How you rank, and I was thinking about, you know, certain sports podcasts that like 538 538's a politics one, but the you know, when they talk about sports things and they talk about things like wins above replacement and different metrics to measure, we don't have kind of vetoes above replacement or anything like that to measure presidents with.
It is a kind of a stupid exercise when it boils down to it, right? Like, this is not what historians do with the rest of their time, except when they're pulled to ask about rank. You know, we don't sort of...
That's true, although I do think it's interesting that because it's not you and I coming up with a poll, although we could certainly do that or a list.
Yeah.
In aggregate, I guess asking a cohort of historians their views is interesting.
Yeah.
Although, again, how you measure across time and how you can compare somebody from the late 18th century to the early 21st century difficult.
Yeah.
It's difficult to do, but
to be sure. And
frankly, it's a little bit absurd.
I mean, I think like ranking baseball players or ranking like greatest movies of all time or something, you know, those are kind of, you can kind of do that and it's sort of fun. This is, I think, a sort of slightly different kind of exercise, and I'm not sure how much merit it has, but it's fun to talk about.
It is fun to talk about, yes. So having rubbished the exercise, we're now going to talk about it.
As, you know, dismissing it as an intellectual premise, it's a fun, at least, pub conversation. So that these kinds of polls have actually been going on for, I guess, close to 70 years now. I guess the first one of these sorts of things was Arthur Schlesinger Sr. From Harvard did one of these polls in 1948. Where he basically pulled a bunch of his friends, all sort of middle-aged and older, you know, white men with gray hair, about how they ranked presidents. And they've been doing sort of versions of this poll fairly regularly in the 70 years since then. And it's been sort of a ritual now associated with President's Day. Siena College did it for a while. Harvard did it for a while. CNN did it for a while. And this new one that came out this week is from C-SPAN. I guess the big news that came out was attached to this one was where they fit President Obama in the rankings of U.S. presidents.
Yeah, he came in 12th. And so the way these things are usually conducted, they're surveys, they're polls of a group of historians, and the historians give their views on a variety of matters, and there are different methodologies employed. And then they tally everything up and they come up with a result.
Results.
What's interesting to me, David, what was interesting in the 2017 poll, I think, or survey is that Barack Obama placed 12th among on the C-SPAN poll. Interestingly, on the British poll, and we'll get to the British poll in a second, he was ranked a little bit higher, he was 7th. What I find interesting is if you look at all these polls, and I'm looking at, you've got the original Schlesinger poll in front of you from 1948, the top three are always the same.
Yeah.
Lincoln, Washington, and Franklin Roosevelt.
Yeah.
And they, the order might be mixed up, but the ranking between them, but those are always the top three.
Yeah.
Are those your top three?
Well, so actually C-SPAN tweeted, like the night before they released their poll results, they tweeted, guess who will be the highest ranked president in our poll? And I retweeted back very promptly, Lincoln, because he's always the top person in these polls. If you look at all these polls, like Lincoln is always either one or two, Washington is usually two, and then it's Franklin Roosevelt. And you know, see, the top is all the same. I think that's
well, the
predictable.
Rankings sometimes shift.
But not in a meaningful way.
No,
usually it's sort of, you know, very small gradations between them. And what I think is interesting about that is if you look at who Art Schlesinger was polling in 1948 versus who was polled this year, the demographics of who was in the poll is actually radically different. Schlesinger is polling all white men, essentially. Maybe not even essentially. I think he was polling all white men, mostly of a fairly affluent background, Ivy League education, that kind of thing. The C-SPAN poll, I think, was a much more diverse poll in terms of who it was polling. So it had lots of, you know, African Americans in the poll. It had lots of women who were involved in the poll. So it was a much more diverse polling group. But their answers aren't all that different, right? And I think that even though maybe the questions we ask aren't...
Why do you think that's so?
I think the easy answer is that who the best presidents are is pretty much the same now as it was in 1948, I think. Lincoln and Washington and Franklin Roosevelt are the most important presidents the United States has had.
You're a 19th century historian by trade, David, and a specialist in the Civil War, so are you pleased that your guy is top? I hesitate to use that kind of phraseology because he's not your guy. But
I'll claim him for this. I mean, part of the problem with any of these kinds of polls is that what one accomplishes in the White House and how one is remembered historically is in part predicated on a number of factors which you have no control over. Lincoln is, you know, the most important president in large part because he was the president during the most important crisis the country ever had, and he did, I think, a very good job during that crisis. If you had put him if he had happened to be president in the 1880s, you know, he'd probably not be ranked as highly. You know? Same with FDR. He's president during the Great Depression and World War II. I think part of the reason why he's ranked so highly is he was president during an important time.
Washington get too much credit for being first? Is he the if we're taking our sports analogies, is he the Babe Ruth of this, and so he just gets too much credit? Sorry, Doug Bradburn.
Yeah. Well, I mean, one of the problems I have with these polls is, you know, they say the greatest presidents, you know, Schlesinger had these categories, great, near great, average, below average, failure. I don't even really know what great means. You know, Schlesinger just had people rank them. This poll had categories that they had each of the participants rank these different people, not only and their overall rankings, but in individual categories. And their categories were public persuasion, crisis leadership, economic management, moral authority, international relations, administrative skills, relations with Congress, vision, pursued equal justice for all, performance within context of times. You know, I'm not quite sure that those are, you know, are we evaluating these people based on our feelings about, you know, how well they did based on the own standards of their time. You know, there are some figures that, you know, may have been very successful, but I also don't think were particularly admirable, at least not using the values that we have in 2017. You know, one can make an argument that you should put James K. Polk at the top because he fulfilled all of his campaign promises in 4 years, and then he retired. But I'm not quite sure that's how we're going to define greatness. So what exactly great means, I think, is pretty amorphous.
All right, I will say, as somebody who has participated in one of these polls, I participated in the British poll, which wasn't a British poll so much as a poll of scholars based in Britain.
Yeah.
And it was more or less people who self-identified and volunteered to participate. Mm. We were given similar criteria, and it was very, very difficult to rank every single president according to things like foreign policy versus domestic policy versus vision.
Yeah, like how do you rank like James Garfield for, you know, administrative skills? You know, I don't. There's a number of these sort of boxes they're trying to put people in that it's just.
So, David, let me ask you, as a 19th century historian. Yeah. Okay, your guy comes top usually.
Yes.
He's certainly in the top three always.
Yes.
But the rest of the 19th century actually gets relatively short shrift.
Because
basically nobody cares about Chester Arthur.
Well, maybe that's with good purpose.
Well, okay.
One of the criticisms of some of these is that the people they pick to put on these panels, very often there's a disproportionate number of 20th centuryists. You know, people who study 20th century history and politics, there's often a number of journalists on these panels, don't know or care very much about the 19th century. And what it means to be a successful president when there isn't kind of the imperial presidency the way there is in the 20th century. You know, Lincoln was successful and important in part because he was president during a crisis. What it means to be a successful president if you're a president, you know, in the post-Reconstruction, the Gilded Age, as sometimes called the period after Reconstruction, if you're a successful president in the 1820s, I'm not quite sure how one evaluates that, at least not in ways that make sense. In some ways, you know, sometimes it's like comparing, you know, this is going back to the sports analogy here, you know, baseball players from the before 1920 to baseball players after 1920, you know, the dead ball era, what, you know. So I think sometimes these, you know, some of these figures could get, you know, trying to figure out how to rank them. I don't think some people are sort of, so it's like our students filling in course evaluations where they're circling three for some of these people because they don't know what else to put.
Right. Okay. Let me ask you, David. Okay, this is the lightning round. Who are your three best presidents and three worst?
Oh, geez. I would put Lincoln. I would agree with all the polls that say that Lincoln is I'm going to have some caveats here. Some of these rankings, I think, often have much to do with who these people were outside of the presidency as it was with who they were during the years they were in office. So some of them people I think are ranked more highly maybe than they should be or ranked in different places as a consequence of that. But getting back to your question. So I put Lincoln, I put Roosevelt, picking a third. I would say I'd put both Roosevelts then.
Really? So you'd put Teddy ahead of George Washington?
I think Washington was important in terms of a study. You know, I think he gets bonus points for setting the precedent for all kinds of things as president. And he obviously gets sort of bonus points for everything he did before he was president.
So he gets a lifetime achievement award the way Grant does or Eisenhower. Now,
well, he didn't always work all that well with Congress.
But of course, working with Congress was a concept
that hadn't been. Yeah, exactly. So he, you know,
it's a bit like saying he couldn't drive a car.
Well, that's, you know. You know, you can think of what were his major legislative accomplishments? Well, tons of things because they had no legislation to start off with, so they had to, you know, create the Judiciary Act of 1789.
So why Teddy then? Why Teddy?
I think in part because he, you know, one of the criteria one could choose for this is the end to which they changed the presidency, and I think Teddy Roosevelt did change the role of the president if you're going from a sort of Gilded Age president, which didn't do very much to sort of the activist presidents of the 20th century. I think I put Teddy Roosevelt as being sort of one of those pivotal points in which the presidency changes using the bully pulpit in terms of his active engagement with the economy in a way that earlier presidents had. And I think, I'm not a great fan of imperialism, but I think Teddy Roosevelt sort of personified a certain kind of foreign policy stance that would preface things that are going to come later. So regulatory state and all these kinds of things. So I think he's somebody who changed the office.
Who are your three worst then?
That's easier. I would put... Can I put Trump in there yet? No. Trump is not in these rankings. A month in is... Maybe not. I would put Andrew Johnson. I would put Nixon. And I would put Buchanan.
Right, okay, I agree.
And those are three, I think, that are usually at the bottom of these lists.
Yes.
With good reason.
Yeah, they are. I agree. And I would agree with your three worst. I'm fairly conventional. I think I have Lincoln, Washington, and FDR as my top three. In terms of the order, I have to say, now, I'm actually working on a book now on Washington, so I'm paying a lot of attention to Washington and have kind of been changing my views on Washington have been evolving almost daily. He kept the United States out of war with Britain in the 1790s, which was no mean feat when war seemed likely in 1794.
Yeah.
Sought to strive to maintain neutrality during the wars of the French Revolution reasonably successfully. Dealt with a difficult yet very gifted cabinet. He's got Hamilton and Jefferson to contend with. And, of course, he's setting precedent. So I think Washington is actually...
Okay, I'll keep you... Washington is...
I would put Washington ahead of Teddy Roosevelt, who's an imperialist, after all.
Well, so the question is, whether somebody's great because of what they accomplished or whether I actually approve of what they accomplished.
Okay, all right, fair enough.
So, yeah. Like, Jackson would be in that category. Like, Jackson, accomplished a bunch of things. Do I like most things? No. But, somebody who was a powerful president, if that's a, that kind of criteria for greatness, and I don't...
No, but with somebody like Jackson, you're right, but somebody like Jackson, what he accomplished, for example, the direct consequence of the bank war was an economic downturn. So even in the context of his time, it's difficult to...
But he was very popular.
Right. Before we wrap this up, maybe we should briefly have a look at the British list, because it is interesting.
One more thing before we get to the British list. I think it's really actually the one value of these polls is not so much who you put at the top and the way you listen. It's looking at who moves on these lists.
Yes, I agree.
Who's at the bottom tends to be the same people. Who's at the top tends to be the same people. Who's in the middle? It doesn't really matter which order you put, Chester, Arthur, and Van Buren, and who cares? But the people that move, I think that tells me about the values of the people who are making the adjudication.
So it tells us something as historians about the time.
Time, yeah. So it's a historiographic kind of, One of the people that was listed as, one of the two people that Schlesinger listed as a failure in 48 was Grant. And in fact, Grant in some of these polls was ranked as the worst president ever. And now, in the most recent poll, Grant is somewhere near the middle.
He's 22nd. He's exactly in the middle.
So, I think that's one of the people whose presidency has been radically reevaluated, especially in the past three or four decades. And I think, some of it may be getting him bonus credit from his, generalship during the war, but, his presidency, which was seen, by an earlier generation as very corrupt and venal and whatnot, now is being recognized as an administration that did stand up for civil rights in the South, that fought against the Klan, that tried to rebuild Reconstruction after the disaster that was the Johnson administration. So, Grant has really risen in the rankings by a huge amount. I think that's important.
So, I agree. And what accounts? I think you're right. It's revealing as a historiographical exercise as much as anything. What accounts for his original poor ranking then?
So I think part of it was, the Dunning School in 1948 was still very significant and influential. And for those people who aren't versed in Reconstruction historiography, the Dunning School were these historians, mostly trained at Columbia, were very influential in the first half of the 20th century in basically putting the blame. They thought Reconstruction was a failure. They thought giving African Americans rights was a mistake. They thought that the radical Republicans and they would throw grant, they would throw grants in that, that under that label, were tyrants who imposed a very brutal conquest over the South, and that's an interpretation that historians, I think, have basically totally abandoned, if not, you know, buried a long time ago. And I think Grant's elevation on these lists, I think, reflects the or his low status originally, I think, reflects the influence of the Dunning School, and his higher status now reflects the sort of new ways in which historians think about Reconstruction.
Right. Interesting. So if we look at the British list,
okay,
the
British list.
I mean, the one thing,
and
one,
you were on the
I was, well,
and I was not. So this tells you about the relative status of the two of us in the profession here on this island. That, and you're a political historian, and I'm not. But
what's interesting, I think, it's broadly similar to the American list, except they've got at the top FDR. Now, to be fair, it's almost a statistical tie between Lincoln and Roosevelt, but yeah. FDR just edges ahead of FDR ages ahead of Lincoln
by less than
a percentage point. Anyway, however, I wonder if that doesn't reflect, because they've got Woodrow Wilson ranked quite highly as well at sixth, which really surprised me. So I think there's a 20th century bias, and yeah. If one looks at who contributed to the survey, they were tended to be, as you suggested before about the Americans, more 20th century oriented.
Yeah.
But also, perhaps because we're outside of the United States, also a little bit more foreign policy oriented.
I think that's right. I mean, looking at this list, the privileged place given to, you know, presidents who focused on foreign policy, I think, is quite pressing. They also decided on the British list to not force people to rank William Henry Harrison or James Garfield, neither of whom served, you know, less than a year in the office. So ranking them is probably a fool's errand. But they rank John Adams pretty high.
John Adams is 10th on the British list, and he's 18th on the C-SPAN list. So that was one that jumped out at me as an exception. And the British British-based historians have Barack Obama quite high at 7th.
Yeah,
which is interesting.
It is always interesting to see where you know the historians put people right after they leave office, because the other person who's moved a lot in the American list is Harry Truman, and I can see on the British list that Harry Truman is now, you know, ranked on actually all the sort of modern lists pretty highly.
That's right. He's 8th on the British list, and if I look at C-SPAN, he's 6th.
Yeah. Whereas I think some of the earlier polls had put, you know, Truman much lower. And so I think, you know, the historical judgments of how successful these, you know, presidents are sometimes changes fairly radically.
Well, we wait and see where President Trump will be ranked.
So why do you think Obama's where he is on these lists? Obama, you know, is ranked between Woodrow Wilson and Monroe, which is an interesting sort of trio to be among.
Well, it's interesting he's so high among the British academics, because I think throughout his presidency, Barack Obama was more popular outside of the United States, at least in Europe. Mm. I mean, people in South Asia might have a different view than he was in the United States. Mm. I think Europeans in particular, and I know this having lived in Britain throughout the Obama years, you know, Obama maintained his popularity here throughout his presidency. So I think that in part that accounts for it.
Yeah.
I think he's also popular among American historians. I mean, he came out quite highly. I think, what is it, 12th on the C-SPAN list. I don't know whether it's a bit like Hall of Fame voting for baseball, whether he'll move up as a result of this or move down.
Yes.
I also think that as we get some perspective, I mean, it looks like, to talk about contemporary politics, the Affordable Care Act might have more staying power than first anticipated.
Mm.
I think if that survives in any kind of meaningful way, that President Obama's reputation will probably be enhanced.
Mm.
I also think there will be a tendency to see him in light of his successor and what happens there. So to some extent, and this data was not influenced by President Trump, but I wonder if President Obama's future rankings might be affected by people's perception of what happens during the Trump presidency.
Yeah.
But he's starting quite high, actually.
To be sure. You know, Lincoln is high, and the two people who are on opposite sides of him are near the bottom. And what that, you know, one always looks better by comparison to the ones neighbors, I guess, or worse. Right.
You mean in terms of the presidency, not in terms of FDR and Washington in the rankings.
Yeah, yeah. So, you know, sort of transitioning to our second topic, President Trump had a news conference over the weekend.
Well, a rally.
Rally.
Yeah, news conference last Thursday.
Okay, so a rally in Florida. And one of the things he said in the rally was he complained about the media, as he does whenever he gets a chance, but he compared himself in his fight against the media, the war against the media, the great enemy of the American people, or whatever it is he says in his Twitter account, to the struggles that other American presidents have. And he listed three. He listed your man, Thomas Jefferson, yep, my man, Abe Lincoln, and he mentioned Andrew Jackson, all of whom, had, he said, had struggles against the media that he, and he thought his was in the same vein as that. What sense did you make of his comparison there?
Well, he said, and I'm going to quote now, and I'm going to quote him verbatim, quoting Jefferson.
Okay.
I won't seek to impersonate him. He said, so Trump at his rally in Melbourne, Florida, on last Saturday, said, when Thomas Jefferson said, quote, "Nothing can be believed which is seen in a newspaper. Truth itself," he said, "becomes suspicious by being put into that polluted vehicle." That was on June 14th, my birthday, 1807. So that's me quoting President Trump, quoting Thomas Jefferson. It's a very revealing quote in a number of ways, but also speaks to something larger, which is why I wanted to talk about this week. First of all, we have that was June 14th, my birthday. Even when quoting Thomas Jefferson, Trump makes it about himself, which was quite telling. But the quote itself is interesting because it is verbatim from Jefferson. So Jefferson did say, "Nothing can be believed which is seen in a newspaper. Truth itself becomes suspicious by being put into that polluted vehicle." And that was in a letter he wrote in June of 1807. Jefferson, and so Trump was not wrong in quoting Jefferson in that way. One reason I was interested in this is it set off a bit of a war on social media between people quoting Jefferson both as a critic of the press and a defender of the press. And it also, there's a huge industry in spurious Jefferson quotes.
The same is true with Lincoln.
Yeah. In this case, this is a legitimate quote, but it comes from a much longer letter in which Jefferson was lamenting the fact that newspapers and newspaper editors weren't careful about publishing the truth.
Yeah.
Now, it should be said, this was in June of 1807. Jefferson had been president since 1801. Every president in history has complained about their treatment at the hands of the press. And so this is a fairly grumpy Jefferson complaining about his treatment at the hands of the press. And he says nothing is true that you read in the newspapers. However, Jefferson had a lot to say about the press over the course of his very long public career and his very long life. Another kind of counterquote that was very prominent on social media in the past few days in response to Trump's quote was a letter that Jefferson wrote in 1787. And in that letter, he wrote, "The basis of our government being the opinion of the people, the very first object should be to keep that right. And were it left to me to decide whether we should have a government without newspapers or newspapers without a government, I should not hesitate a moment to prefer the latter." Now, in other words, Jefferson was saying, "I'd rather have newspapers than the government." And that was quoted widely. There's another sentence there. It's a much longer letter, of course. He said, "But I should mean that every man should receive those papers and be capable of reading them." So what's really important as far as Jefferson's concerned is not just a free press, but an informed citizenry.
Yeah.
And so to some extent, what he's saying in the 1807 letter 20 years later, what he's lamenting is the fact, not that he says actually in that letter, newspapers publish facts, but people can't discern the facts. He's worried that the electorate isn't informed enough to discern what it's reading
so they can't pick out the fake news is what he's saying.
Exactly. Okay. Yeah. So Trump goes on about fake news. Jefferson says that ability to discern what's fake news, to use that usage. I think the most useful thing, and this wasn't quoted that widely in the past week, but something to bear in mind, is a letter that Jefferson wrote in 1804 while he was president. And in that letter, and he wrote to a fellow Virginian, he writes about the experiment of the American government.
Hmm.
And if you'll bear with me, the quote's not short, but Jefferson is not suited to Twitter. 140 characters is not the Jeffersonian way of writing. He writes, "No experiment can be more interesting than that we are now trying." And he's talking about the American Republic. "And which we trust will end in establishing the fact that man may be governed by reason and truth." So he's putting his faith in the American people. He's been president now for almost an entire term at this point. "Our first object should therefore be to leave open to him all the avenues to truth." He's talking about citizens. "The most effectual hitherto found is freedom of the press. It is, therefore, the first shut up by those who fear the investigation of their actions." So the people who don't want to be, people who want to abuse power, people who want to undermine liberty, the first thing they go after is freedom of the press. "The firmness with which the people have withstood the late abuses of the press," he's referring to the Alien and Sedition Acts of the late 1790s, "the discernment they have manifested between truth and falsehood show that they may safely be trusted to hear everything true and false and to form a correct judgment between them." So in 1804, he thinks the public is exercising its judgment. He's frustrated by 1807 in the letter that Trump quoted. But if there's a consistent position for Jefferson, it's he believes in the free press, but he also believes in an informed electorate or informed readership that can appropriately discern what the press has to say. He says, "I hold," and here's a warning for Mr. Trump, perhaps, "I hold it, therefore, certain that to open the doors of truth and to fortify the habit of testing everything by reason are the most effectual manacles we can rivet on the hands of our successors." He's talking about the people in government, his successors in the White House, "to prevent their manacling the people." So in other words, a free press is essential as far as Jefferson is concerned. In that letter in 1807, he's frustrated. But if we look at the kind of body of opinion over here, again, over his very long life, he's not always consistent. When one studies Jefferson, one has to kind of learn to live with inconsistencies. Welcome to the human race.
Yes.
But he is fairly consistent in his faith in the free press and his belief in an informed readership or the consumers of that press. I think if he were looking at the contemporary media environment, what he'd be concerned about is that people are believing things, what could be denominated fake news or not, or particular media, without exercising their judgment.
You know, in Jefferson's day, there all the media was partisan, right? There wasn't a, you know,
there wasn't a belief in objectivity.
Yeah, there was no journalistic ethic that we should, you know, present both sides of the argument and have a, you know, neutral, balanced opinion of things. And in fact, I think the period of American history where that is the sort of overarching journalistic ethos, I think it was a lot shorter than people tend to think it was.
It's really the post-war period to, I guess, about, it's almost from 1945 to 2000 or almost something like that.
You might want to push it back a little bit earlier, you know, but,
sure.
but you know.
It's not as long.
At least all of the 19th century, you know, and into the 18th century, all of the media is partisan, all of the media is... you know, writing with the intention of not only sort of selling newspapers, or but also sort of pushing some kind of particular agenda.
And so it's the ability to recognize that agenda and discern that Jefferson thinks is really important.
Yeah, and in some ways we've gone into that era again, in which, you know, a large part of the media seems to have very particular agendas, at least depending on which side the coin you're on.
That's right. I mean, on both sides of the aisle, whether it's red America or blue America, people believe the media on the other side is against them and is lying.
And they think their own media is objective.
Right, exactly. And Jefferson recognized that media may not be objective, but it was still important, and a free press was important. So I think if Mr. Trump had exercised a little more judgment and discretion, you might have realized that the situation was slightly more complicated than he allowed. What interested me as somebody who has written about Jefferson is Jefferson always gets used on any side and either side of any particular political controversy. And this was a kind of case study of that.
And Lincoln is one of the other three people he cited in this list of people, the presidents that were oppressed by the media. Is in the same ways, used by both sides, candidates are often asked who their favorite president is when they're running for office, and they almost always say Lincoln. Why they say Lincoln may be different, but they almost always say Lincoln is their favorite president, much in the same way as the historians who are polled always say Lincoln is is their favorite president. But you can quote Lincoln selectively and out of context and make him say whatever it is you want him to say on any number of questions, and half the quotes you find from him on the internet are
spurious.
Spurious, or possibly partially true or entirely fabricated.
Well, and Jefferson, again, is often used as a bit of a political football as well. So yeah. It's interesting that I think we'll see this over and over.
Again.
And we saw this in response to Trump's quote. People on the right said that, and Trump supporters said that, yes, that's true, Jefferson didn't trust the press. And then people who were critical of Trump used these other quotes from Jefferson to, And as you know, David, what always happens when one of the problems with doing this is people are ripped entirely out of context. And it turns out that, the early 19th century, the mid-19th century, is not the early 21st century. And the context really does matter.
And Jefferson didn't tweet, so you can't, take sort of phrasings of his, his ideas tend not to sort of condense into 140 characters.
Absolutely not. That's right. So, David,
yes.
Last drops. Right. What is your
well,
last drop?
So I've got a weird one, and it's one that only people in a particular geographic area can avail themselves of, and that is an event happening this weekend. So we're recording this on Thursday, and this is an event happening on Saturday and Sunday, the 25th and the 26th of February. It's a tag sale in Durham, North Carolina. Now, why am I advertising a tag sale in Durham, North Carolina? It's a tag sale at the home of the historian John Hope Franklin. I think many of you who are listening to this are familiar with his work. He is probably the most important African-American historian of the 20th century, author of dozens of books, really somebody who changed the field in terms of the historiography on African-American history, but also somebody who was phenomenally important in terms of integrating the professions, being an African-American who was able to teach at white universities, able to take leadership roles in organizations like the AHA and the OAH and the Southern Historical Association. So he's a phenomenally important figure, and he retired. His last job was at Duke University, and he retires in Durham. And this auction is basically the contents of his entire house, and they're going to open up his house for people to go in, and they have lots of his books to go and buy. Other medals and awards he's won are going to be auctioned off. Furniture that he used. For those people who are interested in taking a great historian's library, this is an opportunity of a lifetime. I'm actually kind of glad for my bank account that I'm not anywhere near Durham, North Carolina right now, because otherwise I'd go and purchase a decent amount of his library, or at least try to grab some of it, although I'm imagining that I wouldn't be the only person interested. I had brief opportunities on a couple of occasions to visit Dr. Franklin in his house, and it's an amazing library. Like the collection is historic in and of itself, just because it was his. But autographed copies of things by like W.B. Du Bois, and one time I visited Bill Clinton had just written his autobiography, and the two of them were friends. And there was a lengthy 2 or 3 page inscription from President Clinton to John Hope Franklin, and I think that's probably in the sale. So. Lots of good things to buy if you're in Durham this weekend.
Did he have anything by Frederick Douglass? Because I hear he's doing great things.
I'm not going to comment on that. What's your last drop, Frank?
Right, thanks. Actually, because we had a double today, David, I'm going to have two, all right. So the first is this week not only was Americans mark President's Day, it also was the 75th anniversary of Franklin Roosevelt's order in turning Japanese Americans, which is sort of one of the lamentable moments in FDR's career.
To say the least.
Yeah, indeed. In that context, National Public Radio had an interesting story, which we can link to on our Facebook page, about approximately 900 people from the Aleutian Islands. They were native Aleutians. They were Aleuts who were forcibly removed by the American military, the U.S. military, in 1942, on the grounds of keeping them safe from the Japanese, although there was a terrible quote in the story where one military officer said, well, y'all look like Japs and we don't want to shoot you. And so these people were removed several thousand miles, because Alaska's huge, to internment camps on the mainland in Alaska. And the contrast was made in the story between the circumstances in those camps and the conditions under which German prisoners of war were kept in Alaska, sure. which were much more benign. It's just a fascinating story, and it's a reminder of what happened in the mid-20th century, which was in the terrible circumstances of the Second World War. There was a kind of great ethnic sorting that went on around the world, actually. I mean, we see it with the displacement of German-speaking sure. populations immediately after the war, and, of course, the Nazi program. And I'm not comparing this policy by the United States to Nazism, but what we saw was... War brings out the worst in people sometimes, and governments make mistakes. And so in the grand scheme of the millions of people displaced in the 1940s during the Second World War and its aftermath, this is a very small story, but it's still an important and quite a poignant story, and I can recommend it to people. The second thing I would say, and this is from our perspective as expatriates, I just completed my U.S. tax return this morning, and I have an annual rant about this. I'll be ranting about this next year, I'm sure, in the podcast. The United States is one of very, very few countries, possibly the only country, sometimes Eritrea is cited as another example, which taxes its citizens overseas. Now, for most Americans abroad, they don't have to pay taxes, but they still have to file a tax return. And so I filed my tax return today. And it's just, I find it deeply ironic on two levels. Mm. Usually I find it ironic because, of course, the United States is a country born of a tax revolt, yet it exercises this extraterritorial authority over its citizens where taxation is concerned that no other country does. It's especially ironic this year because, of course, we now have a president who likely hasn't paid taxes
in 20 years.
In 20 years. Yeah. And so here I am dutifully paying my taxes when the occupant of 1600 Pennsylvania Avenue probably hasn't done so. Although I guess we can expect a tax return from him.
Yeah, he's probably filed a tax return. Right. He probably hasn't actually paid any.
So anyway... If you're an American abroad, you are obliged to file your taxes, your tax return. You do have an extra 2 months.
And I've run into lots of expats who have neglected to do this and gotten in, will probably be in serious trouble if they ever get caught by the IRS for not paying their back taxes for 20 years. I think actually Boris Johnson got in trouble for not paying his U.S. taxes because he was born in the United States and didn't realize...
And he's a dual national.
Why, and as a consequence, so he had like 45 years of not filing his taxes or something. Oops. All right, so this is actually our last episode together, Frank. You are off on one of your great expeditions across the United States.
I'm about to go on the road. America, I'm coming at you.
So we're going to be doing it via Skype for the next few weeks. For those of us, or those of you who want to find us online, we're at whiskeyrebellion.podbean.com. You can like us on Facebook and follow us on Twitter, Whiskey Rebel, at Whiskey Rebel Pod. We're hoping to get lots of reviews on iTunes. I think that's one of the ways we're hoping new people will find the show. The more reviews we've had on iTunes, the higher it gets in the rankings. We've got only 5-star reviews thus far.
Yeah.
We've got 5 5-star reviews. I'd like next week to have like 10 5-star reviews, but we'll start with 5. 5 is good. We've got 2 people who actually written reviews.
David, don't put your thumb on the scale. Let people make their own ratings. Although, but give us 5-star reviews.
It's like Uber. You have to give everybody a 5-star review, otherwise they don't, the car doesn't come. But to encourage, because I know you guys have no incentive to write a review, so I'm going to give you an incentive to write a review, but not particularly enticing one. I'm going to give a copy of my book, and I'm going to make a detailed, heartfelt inscription in it so you can, love it and cherish it for the rest of your life. My new book on Civil War refugees. I will give it to a randomly selected person who writes a review between now and the 1st of June.
And I will do the same with my recent book on the American Revolution.
Oh, geez. Now we get to pick out which book. You guys get to pick which book you want, and then Frank and I will have a, a cry over which one whose cookbook doesn't get picked. Well, no, we'll give away two books. That's fine. We're going to make a huge sacrifice here. So write a review, say nice things or not nice things, as the case may be. But, you know, we want people to be able to find the show, and one of the ways that, people do find the show is by looking at the rankings in iTunes, and this helps us become visible. So until next time, cheers, Frank.
Cheers, David.